When filmmaker Anthony Laddish started following around this serious record collector named Johnny Stark, he was hoping to go to, like, flea shops and stuff. He pictured shots of Johnny digging through stacks of vinyl, so he'd be there when he made that one amazing find, which he would then follow from junk bin to dance floor. That's not quite how it panned out.
Hey, man, it's Johnny. I think I have a record. You're not going to like the way I found it, but it's our record, man. I can feel it. Give me a buzz.
We'll talk about how Johnny found the record in just a minute, but first, the record itself.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime record. Tony Ashley was a Kansas City artist in the 60s who had the most amazing voice. He made these songs that were so sweet you'd cry, and songs so rough that you had to dance.
Here it is, Tony Ashley, Just a Taste.
I'm not asking you to spend a lifetime with me.
Short film about this record, the guy who made it, the guy who found it, and the history of soul music in Kansas City is called 45, The Search for Soul. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with filmmaker Anthony Laddish. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Gina, how are you?
Good, and record collector Johnny Stark. Hi, Johnny. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having us.
So, I'm going to start with you, Anthony. The idea for the movie, like, tell us the backstory.
Years ago, I made a different film about record collecting because I've been, collecting records since I was a kid. And if I'm being honest, I don't think I really did that great of a job. It just kind of turned out to be, 15 minutes of people telling stories about collecting records. And I struggled with the idea of how to really create a narrative. And then now years later, and Johnny and I are friends, and John's a filmmaker as well. And we work together a lot. And I kind of, knowing Johnny and his voracious appetite specifically for soul music, I kind of crafted this idea that I wanted to make a movie that I could shoot really quickly, show him, out digging for records, taking him home, putting him in his collection, then putting it back on the dance floor.
One character, one story.
One character, one story. That's kind of my bag.
All right. And Johnny, what about you? How did you get into record collecting and soul music?
I think I could probably blame that on my parents. I just grew up in a household where music was really, really, really prevalent. And, we had vinyl everywhere in our house. It's how my dad listened to music. And so for me, it wasn't this cool niche thing. It was just how you listen to music when I was young. And, we always had, my parents always listened to 60s music. There was a lot of soul music and rhythm and blues. So it's just kind of a thing that I grew up with. And as I got older and started realizing that the things that I knew weren't all of the soul music, I started seeking out the kind of obscure, more interesting tracks that I didn't know existed.
Just the sense that there had to be more out there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, I remember the early songs that I started hearing that were like, wow, why doesn't everyone know this? And it really pushed me to try to find more of the music that was unheard, forgotten, that deserved to be heard.
But for you, did Kansas City have something to do with it, like a sort of local pride, or is it more complicated than that, the Kansas City piece of it? Because you have a lot of 45s made here in Kansas City.
Yeah, I think that the city has a lot to do with it. I love Kansas City. I think Kansas City is an incredible city that nationally doesn't get held in the high regard it deserves. But I think more than anything, going to these flea markets and thrift stores and estate sales, I was able to find the records that were made here. And that really pushed me to realize, okay, this is going to be the place that I'm going to find these records. So I ended up just focusing on the music that was here. And once I started learning that there was so much incredible music that was made here that no one was really talking about, it really made that drive stronger to go find those records.
Did finding them make you feel differently about Kansas City?
I think that I think most people that know me know that I'm a little obsessed with history and tradition and things of that nature. And thinking of Kansas City, you know, we always think of the 20s or the 30s, and you think of this really incredible place where jazz music was everywhere and there were clubs and people were coming here from New York or LA to really kind of get that gritty culture that
dim, you know, lighting around the clock.
Exactly. You know, and I think that this music opened up a different Kansas City that I wanted to visualize, this 1960s Kansas City where all of these musicians were here making this incredible music that, you know, it's still hard for me to visualize how it was received by the people that did live here, you know, and especially with some of the research Tony's been doing, getting to talk to some of these people that were around and hear their, you know, version of what it was like makes it so much more exciting for me to visualize this music that, you know, I know, oh, this was recorded in 1966. I can close my eyes and think about, all right, so 1966, these four kids went into the studio on the Paseo and made this record. And, it, you know, it was, to them, it was everything. And then somehow it completely gets lost in history.
So we're going to get into Kansas City soul music in a lot more depth later, but I want to start doing that with the record you found that Tony's movie is about. So, Anthony, tell me about the story of the record that you both kind of explore in this short film.
Well, I think the story of the record is it's kind of, I think that's more Johnny's story, really, but John, I think, I mean, the story of the record and the story of the artist are two different things. So I can tell you the story of the artist, which is that Tony Ashley was a guy who was from a small town in Missouri, and he came to Kansas City to make it in the music business, and he signed to Forte Records, which was a record label that was run by a guy named Ellis Taylor, and he put out one record on Forte, and I think Ellis recognized that Tony was going to have the potential to be a big star, and so he had, through some, you know, business dealings, worked it out with Decca Records to get that Forte record re-released on Decca. And then Decca actually signed Tony Ashley out of Kansas City to a national record deal. And so they sent him to Memphis, where he recorded with Willie Mitchell, and really upped the game of the production value. And so what you heard there with Just a Taste, and if you listen, there's four songs that were recorded for with Willie Mitchell. And if you listen to any of those next to anything that was recorded in Kansas City, the thing that I'm learning, as you know, as I do more and more research, is, and as I talk to musicians that were around and that were on some of these records, was that Kansas
because
City.
Because you are now working on a feature length film.
I am. Yeah, I'm working on a feature length film about Kansas City soul music. And the one thing that people will tell you is that, like, Kansas City did not know how to make a hit record. It wasn't that we didn't know how to write a hit record. It was that Kansas City, for whatever reason, didn't know how. We didn't have a producer that could make a record that sounded like a hit record. So despite anyone's desire to turn Cowtown into Motown, we just didn't have a producer here that necessarily knew how to make that record. And then when you listen to the same artist, a song produced here in Kansas City, and then he goes and he records with Willie Mitchell, who's this, you know, famous producer who's just incredible. And the difference between the sonics of those two recordings is like somebody taking a blanket off of the speakers. And so the record that we found is rare a lot because Decca released one of Tony's records and it kind of didn't necessarily go anywhere, but it was fantastic record. And then they released a second record and he was murdered. And the details of which are foggy, and we're, you know, I'm kind of really deep into trying to research all of that, but he was murdered. And so Decca pulled all the records. And so there's very few of them that even exist anymore. And Johnny happened to find a copy of this, and, you know, we'll kind of leave the how to the movie so people come see the movie. But, we found this copy of the record, and the one thing that we didn't get into in the movie that I will say is that we're pretty well convinced that, and I'll say this and I'll stop and let Johnny take this over because I think, he'll have some wisdom here, but we're pretty well convinced that the record, the copy that we have actually belonged to Tony Ashley.
Whoa.
So take it away, John.
It's definitely, I think that for me, the Crate Diggers that came before me here in Kansas City really kind of kicked that door open and kind of put these artists on high for you know, younger people like me who, when we kind of got into the scene, were like, oh, great, so Tony Ashley, the Trinicas, Louis Shashir, these people, you know, all that legwork was already done, so it was easy for us to be like, okay, so these are the artists that I need to learn about, you know, find out about, find their records, see if I can find something that maybe somebody doesn't know about them. And I think, you know, Tony Ashley is being a forte artist.
Tell me more about that.
So forte was probably the most prominent soul label that came out of Kansas City. And for anyone that really wants to learn about it, Numero out of Chicago did this incredible recap of the label. And like all the releases, it's really thoughtful, well done. There's a lot of good information. And, you know, they do a really good job with the care of presenting the music. So it's not just, we took a 45 and threw it back into the world in a digital format. They, they restore what they can. Things come from master tapes.
They're incredible. They have incredible liner notes. If you want to know the history of forte, I would definitely check out that Numero comp.
With all of this history, and I'm just curious, you mentioned in the movie that these records and this music has either been willfully forgotten or accidentally forgotten. What's your theory on that? Why don't people, there's like a niche, like cult following for it, but that's not like mainstream Kansas City history knowledge.
Sure. And I think Tony made a really interesting point here where Kansas City might not have known how to make a hit record, but not everybody wants to hear a hit record. And for me specifically, the soul that comes out of these records that aren't, you know, Motown music machine quality records, that's something that I find really interesting because it has a character all on its own, being this thing that was made either with poor quality microphones or tape that's been reused 100 times over. You know, and I think that adds to the character of this music. And you see that with...
Is it like, I kind of relate to what you're saying. It's almost like you're closer to the making of it because you can hear the evidence of it being created.
It definitely feels more real.
It's the difference between going to watch Black Panther and then watching a movie that somebody made and put on YouTube and they shot it on their phone. It's like you feel closer to the means of production, I think, in some ways. At least for me, it sounds rougher. It sounds tougher.
And I think honestly, being filmmakers, you know, I remember in the mid '90s when I was seeing films like Clerks or things like that, I was like,
movies.
I can do that. I can do that. Why don't I do this? And I think that's the thing about private press or local records is they make you realize like these are just real people.
You know, I want to play another clip. It's another Tony Ashley song we heard. The song Just a Taste that's in the record you find in this short film. Let's hear a little more Tony Ashley music. This song is I'll Never Be Satisfied.
Excuse me, Mr. Brown, while I go.
So tell me more about Tony Ashley.
So with all of these artists that I try to research here in Kansas City, it's really great when I can find someone that was connected to them or have some history with them. And I was able to locate Tony's brother, who gave me this really incredible insight into his life and how he kind of got into music. There's a rhythm and blues singer named Little Willie John that I really love. I mean, his music's just incredible. And Tony's brother told me this story that, and of course I'm going to botch the year, I think it's 55 or 56, Little Willie John came to the town in Missouri that they lived and played, and Tony Ashley got out, and I mean, Tony must have been 14, 15 years old, and got to see Little Willie John play. And he said that he waited behind the stage door till 2 a.m, and then Little Willie John came out and actually spent maybe an hour talking to Tony Ashley. And he said that changed Tony Ashley's life. He said that my brother, from that day forward, wanted to be a musician, and that's all he ever cared about. And, you know, for me to get these stories like this about people that I only know through their songs, it's just so incredible for me.
More about Tony Ashley?
Well, I think the thing for me about Tony it deals a little bit with the tragedy of his murder, which is that he was a guy that I really truly, when you listen to this music, you can hear a guy who's really on the brink of success, and you can hear a guy, a voice that is just begging for more people to hear it and more people to know about it. And the fact that he was struck down really, like, not even in his prime, like before his prime, it just makes this just like a tragedy for the ages. I just absolutely,
yeah,
I'm fascinated by everything to do with it.
In just a minute, we're going to hear about the soul music scene here in Kansas City in the 1960s and 1970s. This is a conversation that originally aired on KCUR's Central Standard back in April. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here now with Johnny Stark and Anthony Laddish. Johnny is a record collector who searches out old soul 45s made in Kansas City. Anthony is a filmmaker who made a short film about Johnny and is now working on a full-length feature film about Kansas City soul. Hi again, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
What would you guys consider, like, the heyday of Kansas City soul? And just tell me a little bit about, more about, not the music itself necessarily, but like where people would have heard it, that kind of thing.
Well, I think, so not necessarily historical to the 60s and 70s, but historical to the history of soul music, of what Kansas City soul music is and means, was that in the 90s, you know, Johnny mentioned this, that there, you know, there was a crew of record collectors in Kansas City that were all like art kids.
And, I remember it.
you know, your James Trotters and Pat Alexander's another great Kansas City soul guy, and Thomas and Dante and these guys that all did this thing called the Hustlers Convention. And they would throw these massive parties, and they were spinning all this Kansas City soul music. So I truly believe that these guys are responsible for anybody even knowing that this music exists a lot, because when you think about it, and it's like, I know a lot of old, you know, musicians that were around at the time, and a lot of these musicians didn't even know that this music was being made in Kansas City at all. Because Kansas City is such, so racially divided that, you know, you really, generally speaking, nobody would cross the tracks to go to a black club and see, you know, black soul bands.
But presumably there were black audiences.
There were black audiences, and then the other thing that's really interesting is that it was like you would play in the clubs, and in Kansas City, Missouri, clubs closed down at a certain time, and so these bands would play, and they would play until, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock, and then they would literally pack up their stuff and they would head over to Kansas City, Kansas, where the clubs were open until 5 a.m. and they would go and they would play another gig, and they would play all night long, basically. And
Is it that nobody knew, or that no white people knew?
I don't think that. Well, no, it's not that no. Yeah, it's not that no one knew. It's that I don't think, you know, white musicians or white music fans were necessarily crossing the street to go, you know, see these bands. And though I will say the one caveat to that is that for the feature we interviewed a guy named Alan Bell, who is really significant in that he booked a lot of these bands. He was a booking agent and manager for a lot of these bands. And largely he was booking them into like white high schools and fraternities and military bases. And so, you know, you didn't have to cross the street necessarily to go see these bands. So there was some exposure there, but it's really shocking to me how many people have no idea that this was a, like, it's like a secret history of Kansas City because we're known for jazz and nobody ever really talks about this whole music. So,
well, and I think a big thing that should be put into this story is that Marva Whitney is probably one of the most well-known artists to come out of Kansas City's soul scene. And I think that she was picked up pretty young by James Brown and got put on tour with him, made records through King that he produced. And when she came back to Kansas City, which I'm probably going to guess is 69, 70, she got tied in with Ellis Taylor on his Forte label and got to put out a lot of great music here in Kansas City.
You know, I was surprised that Marva Whitney was not on the list of musicians that you were going to play for us today. You did bring in some music, and I want to start with what you call the funkiest record to come out of Kansas City. And I almost don't want to say anything else to set it up because this song is recognizable to me, and I think it might be to a lot of other people. I didn't know it was a Kansas City song, so let's give it a listen. Okay, explain.
I don't remember exactly when I heard this song for the first time, but there's something so magical about it. I mean, it's this, I mean, it's the 60s in one song. I mean, it's this beautiful kind of protest and empowerment song, and, you know, it's very beautiful, it's very funky. 1969, I believe. You know, and it's the only record that Curtis Liggins ever made. And it's got a lot of really incredible Kansas City musicians on it, and it's pretty well known. Like you said, you'd heard it before, and not a lot of people think of it as a Kansas City record. And I think it's a record that gets played everywhere. I mean, I think there are DJs in Germany, England, you know, everywhere playing this record, and not a lot of people tie it in with Kansas City, even though if you look at the label, the label says KC Soul right across the top of it. And the really heartbreaking thing is that Curtis Liggins died in 1972 in a car accident. And this record, which is considered by a lot of people just a promo record, a record that he made to help get him gigs on the road, get exposure, you know, not a record that would have been commercially sold. It's a little frustrating, I think, for anyone that loves music to hear these stories because you want to know what else was going to come next.
I want to hear, we'll talk some more in a second, but I want to make sure that we hear some more music. And I want to play what you say all the record collectors in town are after, at least people who are searching out those soul 45s. In this case, it's the producer who's from here, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, so the producer is from here, and this is Louis Shashir, who produced this record and has a career well outside of Kansas City and is highly regarded. He produced this record. The girls who sing on this record are actually from Oklahoma, OKC, and they came down here to record this record. So this record was recorded actually right over by Kauffman Stadium in a studio called Cavern.
Okay, let's listen.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back and talk about why everyone's after this record. ¶¶ So, I mean, other than the fact that this is just a cool sounding record.
So cool.
What's the deal? What is it that makes this the sought after thing?
You know, I think those are my words. And I think that the reason I use those words is that it was actually sampled in a record that in the early 2000s was, I think, a record that turned a lot of younger people, and especially a white audience, onto older soul music. The group was called Jurassic 5, and they sampled the intro to that, which you can thank all of the people that came before me, you know, the James Trotters and the Dantes, for finding that record and wanting to get it in the hands of DJs who worked with bands like Jurassic 5. And I think it's just one of those things that it's a record that didn't have legs really before that Jurassic 5 sample. I think that I've heard people say, oh, I had a box of those and I was selling them for $10. And now it's a record that, I mean, if you can get it for under $500, it's, you know, that's a pretty good get.
Let's talk to Janice in Kansas City, Missouri, about her memories of this stuff. Janice, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you very much. I appreciate the show today.
What can you tell us?
I graduated from Van Horn High School in 1967, and we had Little Willie and the Hideaways. Now, is that the same Willie that your guests are referring to?
No, it's actually not. Little Willie was a local act here, but I've actually always wanted to hear Little Willie's music, and I know he made an acetate, but I've heard some incredible stories about especially his live performance.
Yes, yes. And I was there at some dance where, and actually he came multiple times to Van Horn. I ran into him at a jazz venue not too long ago, maybe several years ago, and he remembered his Van Horn gigs. But we even had one evening where we opened up the doors and went outside into our patio, and the janitors told us to lock up when we left, and they left. And another interesting thing was his James
Wait, so the
Brown,
students the students just like hosted a show and the school kind of was like,
well,
see ya.
I think it was one of our major dances, like after basketball or track season, where we, you know, we did the crowning of the princess and the king and the queen. But then we all got down and seriously boogied. And I was a serious a boogie dancer at that point in my life.
Well, what
still enjoy it.
What can you tell us about the spirit of it at the time when it was being performed live, too? Like, we're talking about the record collecting, but you were there face-to-face with these musicians.
Right, right. And I think those of us who felt like we were really in the groove felt that we were on the cutting edge of cosmopolitan. And I think it really made us feel like we were, you know, into the Kansas City groove. Another thing that was very popular at that period of time was the Boom Boom Room and the Vanguard. I don't know if you're... guests are aware of those venues, but the Boom Boom Room was one of the most, the classiest dance club you could go to if you were under 18 or 21, and it was on Main. You went upstairs, and they always had a most excellent band, and often they were the Kansas City soul bands and rock, and we didn't use the word funk back then, but it was pre-funk, I guess, and we would have a good time in the Boom Boom Room. the Vanguard tended to be more folk music, so
super interesting.
If you could hit both of those clubs on the same night, that was a hot date.
Well, thanks, Janice, for sharing those memories.
Well, thank you, and I'll hang up and continue listening. And I'm so glad your guests are doing research on this. It's an important element of Kansas City's music that we continue to learn about. Thank you.
Thanks. You know, Anthony, you've mentioned that you have been doing a lot of research. Is there anything else that just you want to jump in and say right now? We haven't heard from you in a while.
I'm just enjoying listening to Johnny talk about it's so funny because Pat Alexander is along for the ride with me making this feature. And I'm sure we're going to be tapping into Johnny's wealth of knowledge and resources as well along the way. And it's just been really incredible for us to be able to go out and talk to people. So one, there was a band in Kansas City called Tommy and the Derbies, and it was Tommy and James Gadson, the Gadson brothers, that had this band. And James Gadson went on to play with Bill Withers and played on a lot of Motown hits. And, you know, we were able to go out and talk to James, and hearing him talk about the Carpets, and which was the band that they had before Tommy and the Derbies, and you know, hearing what it was like to be like a 13-year-old kid sneaking out of the house to go make doo-wop records, and, you know, has been just absolutely enlightening to me.
Do you know, we have a clip here that Johnny brought in. Is the Derbies, that's what we're talking about?
Yeah, this is an early one for them.
Let's give it a listen. I need somebody. So tell me more. I mean, you can definitely hear that thing you were talking about before, about it's not the perfect production, but it's intimate, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely. And I think the great thing about these local kind of records are they kind of transcend a time where this song really has elements of 50s doo-wop with rhythm and blues, but it's still this early soul record.
Is there anything else to say about, is there a Kansas City sound in soul, or is that the production sound is the Kansas City sound?
Well, so I think one thing is that I think the in Kansas City soul music, I think the drummers were funky, and that goes back, I think, a lot to our history with Kansas City jazz and the fact that, you know, a lot of these sort of like four on the floor, you know, swinging rhythms came, you know, from Kansas City, from Kansas City Big Band.
Johnny Stark and Anthony Laddish made a movie called 45, The Search for Soul. I'm Gina Kaufman. Still to come on this morning's Encore presentation, why do we collect souvenirs from our travels? A local author found some surprising answers to that question. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm here with travel writer Rolf Potts, whose newest book is about to hit the shelves. And it's not about the places he's visited, but what he brings home with him. The book is called Souvenir. Hi, Rolf.
Hey, Gina. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. What is interesting to you about souvenirs? It's something that people don't give a lot of thought to.
You know, I didn't give a lot of thought to it either. At least individual souvenirs. But as I traveled over the years, actually at the end of this year, it will be my 20th year as a full-time travel writer. I've written a lot about individual journeys, but there are certain factors that connect different journeys. And I think over time, the idea of what I bring home has affected my travels, my memories, and they've sort of framed how I recall my travels over the years, and they have a sort of, they tell a story of their own that's a little bit counterintuitive, and the more I wrote the book, a little bit existential. I think the moment I knew that I had a book to write about souvenirs is when I learned that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, when they went to Shakespeare's estate in the late 18th century, they took out a knife and carved off parts of Shakespeare's chair to take home as wood chips.
Did anyone object to that?
They didn't. It was actually part of the souvenir ritual. We think of tourism now as a mass culture phenomenon. But back then, it was an aristocratic thing. And there was no interpretive information at Stratford. And so the servants, basically, who had been bribed to let them on the estate, gave them a knife and said, this is what people do. And of course, if 10,000 people a month visit a place, then you can't really do that, or else you'd have to supply a lot of chairs.
Well, let's go back to your story. I mean, you grew up in South Central Kansas, and your first souvenir was from a trip to Chicago. It was what you thought was a seashell.
Correct. You know, I think I was 7 years old, and I saw Lake Michigan. And unlike the reservoirs in Kansas, I couldn't see the other side, and it felt like an ocean. And even though it was a clamshell, I called it a seashell, in part because I was wowed by the metropolis of Chicago, but also because I was sort of dreaming of points beyond. I sort of was hoping that someday I would see an ocean in person.
What, take us to that moment where you pick up this clamshell and decide to take it home? And talk to us about what you did with it and what it began.
Well, it's really interesting. The meaning of that seashell or that clamshell changed over time. I think at the time I was just excited to find anything that seemed like the natural world. I was probably in Lincoln Park in Chicago. And I tucked it away into my day pack and I displayed it proudly in my room. And I really used it as an object to dream of points beyond, which is funny because I've been a travel writer for a long time now and I've seen plenty of oceans. Interestingly, and this is something that I meditate on in the book, there was a point at which I lost track of that seashell that clamshell that meant so much to me when I was young. I think because I went to college in Oregon, I lived in Asia for a while, and the idea of dreaming about an ocean became a reality, and that object no longer served the present. And of course, now it's sort of sad that I lost track of that seashell because it reminds me of who I was when I was 7, and I think it helps me appreciate the dreams that I had when I was young that have come true in so many ways. So that's just one example of a souvenir that had very important meaning at one time, and its meaning has changed over time to the point where it became something that I could cast aside at a certain point in my life.
Right. I mean, more recently, like when you started this book, you had been collecting, sort of subconsciously collecting masks in Asia.
Yeah, that's another interesting story. And some of the social scientists who study tourism say that tourists just like masks. Cultures who don't have mask performances in their dance drama, they carve masks because tourists ask after masks, especially in continents like Africa, where there's so many cultures mixing together that, you know, one tribe might make masks because they're jealous that the tribe, you know, one valley over is selling a lot of masks. In my situation, as I was in my earliest travels through Asia, every country I went to, I would buy a dance drama mask for my collection. And after about 6 countries, when I got to Mongolia, I realized I didn't know why I was doing it because I wasn't going to dance dramas. I was just buying these sort of exotic seeming masks in gift shops. And what I realized is that my friend had a mask collection. And when I was dreaming of traveling across Asia, I would look at those masks and sort of dream my way into that further trip. And after a certain point of Asia travel experience, I didn't really need those masks to certify myself as a traveler. I was having more organic experiences. And so now when I have those masks, which I still keep on the wall of my office in Kansas, I don't just think of Asia, but I think of myself as that excited newbie traveler on the continent of Asia, buying masks for reasons he doesn't completely understand.
You know, the relationship between souvenirs and the dreams that send you on journeys in the first place seems interesting to me. Like, it seems like you start with a dream and you come home with a souvenir.
Yeah, yeah. I was just talking to a high school teacher who brought back a Dia de los Muertos mask from Mexico, and he put it in his classroom. And he said it really sparked his students' interest. And I think it's interesting that as wannabe travelers, oftentimes we're inspired not just by the idea of other places, but by these concrete physical objects of other places. I mean, you have National Geographic famously and makes people dream of other places. But I think when you're young and you see these objects that have been brought home by your elders, or you visit a friend's house and see the uncle who served in the military and brought back this, you know, really curious carving from another continent, that really makes the idea of other places seem real. And even in the 21st century, when we get so many images from places like Instagram, there's something to be said for holding an object from a faraway place and really using it as a way of dreaming yourself into that place. I keep using that word dreaming, but it's a recurring thing as I've explored the phenomenology of souvenirs, is that it's really used as an object that's bigger than its singular self.
Yeah, you write some about the word souvenir and the fact that it's a French verb, actually. Like, we use it as a noun, a thing, but the French verb to remember, it literally means to come back to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And so that sort of made its way into English about the time that Jefferson and Adams were carving chips off of Shakespeare's chair, around the time of, you know, when the Industrial Revolution was sparking up, and souvenirs became a really formalized ritual in the tourist industry. But if you go to cemeteries like Père Lachaise in France, you'll actually see the word souvenir on tombstones, because it's about people go to remember their relatives. And so it's only in English that it has a more singular purpose as these objects that we collect that are sort of an agent of memory. and a given object will serve memory in different ways over the course of a given lifetime.
You know, when you mentioned photographs, that is such a big part of how most people do remember travels and remember just important experiences. But I've read about the science of how remembering something through a photograph works, that when you look at this photograph again and again, the path you take back to that memory kind of gets set in stone, and it becomes hard to remember things about the experience outside the photograph. Like, the photograph becomes a stand-in for the experience. And I wonder if it is different when you're looking at a less literal thing, like a clamshell.
Yeah, well, it's more associative. And I forget, Annie Dillard or maybe Susan Sontag wrote really interestingly about how we're looking at the photograph, but we're also remembering the last time we remembered the photograph, right? And it has, a photograph has a direct one-to-one relationship with what is being viewed, whereas a snow globe or a wood chip or a clamshell picked up from the shores of Lake Michigan, it has a different kind of energy that you can't just show it to somebody and say, look, this is what I saw. It has a personalized meaning. And in the book, I talk about how when Neil Armstrong, the astronaut, died, his estate found that he had saved some wrenches and waist tethers from his moon mission that I think to him told a story that was completely different than all the millions of words that have been written about the moon mission. And so I think that's really something about the power of souvenirs to call forth these associative memories that even a photograph can't stand in for.
So in an age of mass-produced souvenirs, how is that the same as carving off your own wood chip or bringing back your wrench? I mean, you write about the gazillions of Eiffel Tower souvenirs that a person can pick up in Paris, for example. Is that the same as your wood chip carving?
It is and it isn't, you know, and it created this authenticity discussion. I dedicate an entire chapter to the idea of authenticity. Is like, is this little trinket that was made in China that depicts a French landmark, is that an authentic representation of experience? And actually, you know, those aristocratic travelers who carved off wood chips from Shakespeare's chair were really irritated by the middle class travelers who came in. One is that there were so many of them that they would destroy those chairs. And two is that they really created a market in trinkets, whereas an aristocratic traveler through his education might buy fine crystal or tapestry that was informed by his education in a certain place like Milan. A middle-class traveler didn't care. They would take a trinket that was engraved with the word Milan, and this still happens. But I think in my investigation of souvenirs, I realized that the authenticity that travelers seek really isn't about cultural authenticity, but about a sense of authenticity in oneself, about being away from home. And oftentimes, it's the first-time travelers, it's the early explorers who buy the trinkets. But in a way, the first time we visit a place like Milan has an emotional power that might be stronger than our more sophisticated self that visits a place like Milan for the 10th time. So as much as we might make fun of the little trinkety, kitschy-type souvenirs, snow globes and keychains and such, in a way, it doesn't matter because it's all about the meaning it conveys for the person who went there. And when you think about going to a place like Paris, for a person who's been there for the first time, I think it reminds you of the miracle of crossing an ocean and seeing a place that you've dreamt about your whole life. So in a way, for as much as we might look down our nose at some of the cheaper type souvenirs, it doesn't really matter what purpose they serve as a social status because it's all a very internal and personalized thing.
You know, I mean, it's interesting to me to think about how all of the memories of your travels come back to you in Kansas. But also, when you talk about authenticity and, you know, I don't know, being away, far away from home, it sounds almost like buying souvenirs and trying to find an authentic souvenir is really about trying to make sure you haven't lost who you are, that you're still a real person and not just lost in the identity of tourist. You know what I mean? Is that, as a travel writer, I mean, do you feel like you need to be reminded that you are still the you from Kansas?
Sometimes, yeah. You know, like if I buy or even just pick up a souvenir that I know where it's going to be in my house, you know, sort of part of this object narrative I have back home, it's sort of a connection to the place I've left behind. And a lot of people who've researched souvenirs and the people who buy them, the ritual of shopping for souvenirs or looking for souvenirs is sort of a comfort ritual in a place that you don't completely understand. You can find a containable part of it to hold to yourself. And in a place that you might only be for a few days, that has so many more things than you could possibly remember, taking one little part of it, even if it's just a cheap keychain or an empty wine bottle from a fun experience you had, then that's a way of keeping and honoring what is in essence an ephemeral experience.
But for all of your acceptance and even sort of honoring of souvenirs, you do have an entire chapter on souvenirs and human suffering.
Yeah, I wanted to acknowledge that because there's sort of a lightheartedness to travel souvenirs, but over the course of many centuries of warfare and also some very ugly chapters in American history involving lynching, cutting off bodily souvenirs, scalps, fingers, which are not meant to be enshrined and kept, but sort of speak to the psychopathy of a lynching event or a war battle, it really creates a complicated situation. And it's something I explore in that chapter. Like if you go to a place like Auschwitz, what do you bring back as a souvenir? And the gift shops in Auschwitz have been wrestling with that. Actually, the gift shop at the 9/11 Memorial in New York has wrestled with that, is that how do you honor something that's very solemn at the same time, giving the visitors a tangible thing to remember it with? And I also bring up Mount Vernon.
I'm curious why you think that places like that do have gift shops. I mean, if the experience is so solemn, maybe the place itself is the memory.
Well, you would think so, but a refrain I heard often again and again is that the reason souvenirs are offered, or the reason a certain type of souvenir is offered, is because that's what people want. And, you know, when Auschwitz stopped selling souvenirs, people started stealing parts of Auschwitz. They started taking bits of barbed wire and brick. And so it became a very complicated thing where they're actively trying not to disturb the solemn atmosphere of the place, but people somehow weren't happy with just a memory of this solemn place. They wanted something to make the sorrow of this place very, very strong. And so that's one of the things that I explore. Also the idea that men who are in battle will go to great lengths to bring back little mementos of war, often risking their lives. And it's often, an analyst said it, as a way of reminding themselves that they will once again have this normal domestic life. So it's a really complicated thing. It could almost be its own book. But I wanted to acknowledge that amid the more frivolous and whimsical souvenirs, that there are some very, very serious souvenir rituals out there.
You know, it's interesting that the more you talk about this, I think I've always had this idea of souvenirs as a commercially driven thing, but it sounds like it is just a deep human impulse.
It is, and it goes back to childhood when we sort of identify the world by picking things up and holding them in front of our face or even showing them to older people. And so I think... Show and tell, yeah. And I don't think I fully appreciated that until I went through my house and realized how many souvenirs I had that I don't even think of as souvenirs. They're just sort of ways of organizing the world and my life's journeys through it.
Can you, on the way out, tell us about one little souvenir you have?
Is there a specific one you have in mind?
Nope.
Or you? Okay, free association. Well, I am a Kansas City Royals baseball fan, and I have a little shrine of baseballs and ephemera, especially from the 2014-15 season. I realize it's not a travel souvenir, but it has an emotional strength, as any Kansas City Royals fan would attest.
Yeah. Well, Rolf Potts, our time is up. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Gina.
Rolf Potts is a travel writer. His most recent book is Souvenir, and I talked to him earlier this spring when it came out. You can hear any of our shows online at kcur.org/centralstandard. And we are gathering stories about Kansas City floods, how you remember them, what you experienced. Tweet us those stories. We're at KCURCST, or email us, centralstandard@kcur.org. This morning's show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date. Next.